Good afternoon, good evening to those of you on the East Coast. I'm Condoleezza Rice. I am director of the Hoover Institution here at Stanford University, and I want to welcome you to this very special webinar. We are going to celebrate International Women's Day, which is March 8th. We are also going to celebrate National Women's Month, but we're going to celebrate it in a very special way, which is to engage with four scholars who are well known for their work as academics, their work as policymakers, their work as diplomats. They are all fellows of the Hoover Institution, and the Hoover Institution has spent the last 100 years or so trying to bring the best research and the best data and the best ideas to policy challenges that face free peoples and free societies in an effort to make certain that the future for freedom is indeed bright. My guests, or I should say my colleagues today, are Rose Guttmiller. Rose is with us as a Hoover Fellow. Rose was the Deputy Secretary General of NATO most recently, but has had a wonderful career as a diplomat, a wonderful career in working through some of the hardest problems of international security and arms control. We have with us Professor Amy Ziegert. Amy is the Morris Arnold and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. She is a specialist in national security, technology, and intelligence. We have with us Elizabeth Economy, Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution and Senior Fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Liz is one of the best known specialists on modern China. And we have with us Ayan Alihirsi, who is a Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution and is a specialist on the Middle East and issues of Islam, culture, and the challenges facing Islam. Now, all of these women have something else in common. They have either just published books or they are about to release books. And so both in an effort to give you a better idea of who they are, but also so that you can write down the names of their books so that you can buy them. I'm going to ask each one to give you just a little how I got to where I am, as well as a little bit about the books that they are writing or have written. I'm going to start with Rose Guttmiller, but I told the women here that I always start these conversations by saying that I was a failed piano major who ended up in international politics. So with that opening, Rose, over to you.
Well, Gandhi, thank you for the fun of this panel. It's really a super idea, and I'm so delighted to be here with you and my esteemed colleagues. Great way to celebrate International Women's Day. Well, if you are a failed piano student, then I am a Sputnik baby, because I got very interested in studying Russian language way back at the time of Sputnik in the late 1950s when I was living as a child in Columbus, Ohio. In those days, you may remember the Defense Language Act. I had the opportunity even to study Russian in high school and got my undergraduate degree at Georgetown in Russian. And after that, had the good opportunity of falling into a job at RAND Corporation with Tom Wolf, who was the senior Soviet military analyst at RAND in those days, and was writing a book called The SALT Experience about the first strategic arms limitation negotiations in the early 1970s. So I was his research assistant for that book. And after that, I was hooked. Turns out Tom was a great mentor and he helped me to push forward in my career onto graduate school and then working both in think tanks and for President Clinton and President Obama. I never expected when I was writing a book about SALT I that I would end up being the chief negotiator of a strategic arms treaty, a New START treaty. I was asked to do that by President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2009, and it was a wild and wonderful ride. My book, which is called Negotiating the New START Treaty, will be out this spring, and it talks about two very important negotiations, One is the all-important negotiation, of course, with the Russians. Remember, that was a particular moment, the reset. Remember the reset? Seems like a century ago. But also President Medvedev was in office in the Kremlin then, and President Obama and he did a lot to negotiate the New START treaty together. But I and my team in Geneva, of course, were working on the technical side. After that, we moved on to the second very important negotiation, which was the negotiation with the US Senate to get their advice and consent to ratification. People often ask me which of those two negotiations was more important. And I have to tell you, they are both equally important because treaties are the highest law of our land. And if we can't get treaties across the finish line and through the process of ratification in the Senate, then I think we are doing ourselves out of that very important legal tool. So my book tells that story, and I'm looking forward to hearing what people think about it. So look for it in the spring. Thanks a lot, Condi. Back over to you.
Well, Rose, we have something else in common, of course, including in addition to Russian language. I also was a Defense Languages Act baby. To learn Russian in those days was actually the patriotic thing to do. And I think a number of us were attracted to the field because of the post-Sputnik push to have people learn those languages. I think if we were to fast forward to today, however, people might say that the patriotic thing to do would be to learn Chinese. Liz. So maybe we can turn to Liz for a little bit on her background and a little bit about your book.
Sure. Thanks, Condi. It is great to be here. And I want to thank you and all the terrific women at Hoover who make the place such a great institution. So I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you because I too started off as a Soviet baby and studied the Soviet Union and Russian in college. That was my passion. I lived in Leningrad when it was still Leningrad before it reverted to St. Petersburg in the sort of early to mid 1980s. Came, as you know, to Stanford and studied with you and Alexander Dalin and all the greats of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe before going to work at the CIA for a couple of years as the Gorbachev analyst, which was a fantastic opportunity and experience, you know, right at the start of his career, of his tenure as general secretary. But when I went off to get my PhD a couple years later, I ended up starting to study China too. My advisors at the University of Michigan suggested that I do comparative communism. And even though I would have stuck with Soviet Union, which by the time I finished in 1994 had transitioned to Russia, there were just no Russia jobs available. There's not a Russia job on the market, not one position. And so I took a China job at the University of Washington in Seattle. And that really is that was the inflection point. That's what started me on the sort of the China track as opposed to the Russia track. And then the sort of second big, I guess, inflection point was, you know, moving from academia to the think tank world. And that also just happened because I got married and my husband lived in New York City and I needed to move. And so I got a job at the Council on Foreign Relations, and that's where I spent, you know, the following 26 years of my career before I was so fortunate to come and join everyone here at Hoover. So that's my trajectory. In terms of my book, the book is called The World According to China. And to some extent, it's a companion book to the book that I published in 2018, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State, in the sense that that book really focused on sort of Xi Jinping's transformative impact on Chinese domestic policy with a little bit on Chinese foreign policy. But this book, The World According to China, is really all about Xi's ambitions on the global stage. And it's, you know, designed to engage the debate, you know, which is really quite active and in some extent quite polarized around, you know, what the rise of China signifies for the United States today. And so it looks at, you know, what are Xi Jinping's ambitions? And it's less about what Xi Jinping says at this point than about the actions and the patterns of behavior underway. You know, certainly I read all 2,000 pages of Xi Jinping's speeches, you know, in his three volumes that he's now published. But I think he's been in power for 8.5 years, and we certainly should be able to discern, I think, at this point, you know, what he's about. And so basically, you know, I just make the argument that if you look through Xi Jinping's eyes, you know, at the world today, you know, he kind of sees it in four concentric circles, you know, sort of China, you know, reunified, sort of China is the dominant power in East Asia, kind of sending the US back across the Pacific, you know, packing its bags, go be a regional Atlantic power again. And then sort of China, you know, on the global stage, you know, in the world where its interests, security, political and economic are embedded through things like the Belt and Road and China's technological dominance. And then finally, sort of China's role in global governance and, you know, institutions like the United Nations, where, you know, Xi is fond of saying that China should lead in the reform of global governance institutions. So it's all about how Xi Jinping really is trying to, you know, reorder the world order. And then, you know, I talk about how he's doing it and, you know, what the United States should do in response.
Great. Thank you. Well, Amy, when I first met you, you were also going to be a China specialist. So we seem to have a theme here. I don't think you were ever going to be a Soviet specialist. I think you're probably too young to have cared about Gorbachev. No, I'm just...
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but not true. I'm not too young. So I was originally a China person. I grew up in the hotbed of the study of China in a place called Louisville, Kentucky, where I watched Deng Xiaoping visit the United States on TV and was captivated by this country. And my mom's an antique dealer and she can find someone, something for everyone. So she found a Taiwanese immigrant who started teaching me Chinese after school. Loved it, was an East Asian studies major. And then came to Stanford and walked into a class that was taught by two incredible and incredibly difficult and demanding professors, Condi Rice and Terry Carl, and became fascinated by civil-military relations and the creation of the national security state. And so I moved from China to thinking about organizations and national security. And like any good political scientist, I couldn't just do a single case study on the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the National Security Council. I needed a third case. And so I found my third case in the National Security Act of 1947, and it was called the Central Intelligence Agency. And I was hooked on intelligence and have been hooked on intelligence ever since. So now this book, which is called Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, the History and Future of American Intelligence, is really a different kind of book for me. It looks at the history of our 18 intelligence agencies, the CIA and the 17 others, and how they operate today, but more importantly, how emerging technologies are challenging everything they do for tomorrow. So it's a bit about the past, the present, and the future. And I really started this book with two questions. One was, what don't people know about our intelligence community that they should? And by people, I mean everyone, from members of Congress. There are more powdered milk experts in Congress than there are people who have worked in intelligence agencies before, to the general public. And with the help of folks at Hoover, like Doug Rivers and Dave Brady, I did some polling that found some pretty shocking things. Most Americans learn about intelligence through spy-themed entertainment, which has become adult education. So that's sort of the first question that motivated me, is that we need to better understand how the intelligence community works to have more effective agencies. And then the second question was, what's different about this era with emerging technologies like quantum computing, artificial intelligence, the proliferation of commercial satellite technology, and how can we think about how this technological moment is dramatically affecting the race for what I call the race for decision advantage, which is what intelligence agencies provide. So those were sort of the two motivating questions of the book. And the hope is that the book will be the basis of a new class that I'll be teaching at Stanford next spring, and that my students will actually read it.
Great, thank you. Now we have, Liz, I'm not sure, where were you born? I think, so Rose is from Ohio. Amy's from Kentucky.
I was born outside Buffalo and grew up in San Jose.
All right, Buffalo and San Jose. Ayan, you were not born in Buffalo or San Jose or in Kentucky. Ayan is an immigrant, which is a different perspective. But Ayan, you also have had a very interesting pathway to where you are. And so if I could say that Russian was once the language of the future, and maybe Chinese still is, Arabic is perpetually a language for national security. So talk to us a little bit about your background and the work that you have done in the book that was already out as of February, I believe.
I wasn't born in any part of the United States, but I can't tell you how excited I am and grateful I am to be in the room with you, Condi, and with Rose, with Amy, with Elizabeth, Liz. I know you go by Liz. And looking back into my life, I go back and forth and thinking, I wish I was born in the United States. I wish I wasn't born in the United States. So when I listen to the people, the present day people who go on and on about race, I think, actually, I'm quite glad I wasn't born in the United States, because I can't come in here with a perspective from outside. But back in the day, I was born in 1969, living in Somalia. The world was divided into the Soviet sphere of influence and the American sphere of influence. I was born in the Soviet sphere of influence. And I can tell you comfortably, people my age all wanted to come this way. We all wanted to belong to the American sphere of influence. And I'm not going to bore you with that. That's not what my book is about. But I wanted to go to the comment about when you said, Condi, I'm a failed pianist. I want to say I'm a failed athlete. I had to run the 200-meter, 400-meter sprints. And I thought that that would be my way out of the Soviet Union / Muslim sphere of influence, because if I could accomplish that, I could get scholarships, I could get to be famous like some of my countrymates. There weren't many of them, but I failed at that. So that aside, fast forward, I come as a refugee to the Netherlands in 1992, and that is right after 1989, when all of that collapses. And with the collapse of that two-power globe, we get a lot of civil wars, we get a lot of failed and failing states that continue to fail to this day. And it's very difficult in the post-1989 world, to find any of those powers who is taking responsibility for what's going on in their where they were having the proxy wars. So in continents like Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, I know that the United States has actually done quite a lot, especially under the Bush administration, forced by circumstances to take this stuff on, but life goes on. A great deal of things should have been done differently, should have been done better, resentment, on and on it goes. In my book, I focus on one of those things that are really, they have their roots in the collapse of that world. So the collapse of the Soviet Union also brought down the two-pillar system. And so countries and societies that think that they belong to one or the other never got to the point of developing dual states. In the Middle East, in Africa, in parts of South Asia, states collapse. And what happens to the people? The people move, they migrate. And most of them seem or want to go to a place where they think the way to improve their lives is to go to the so-called mother country. Many of these mother countries, former colonizers, are in Europe. And so we have mass migration, immigration, and into Europe. And from a foreign policy, from a national security perspective, some of these European countries are really facing issues that they've had decades, at least 3 decades to think about, and they haven't done any thinking about. And they're going to be overwhelmed with wave after wave after wave of unmanaged migration. So Prey, my book, focuses on only a teeny tiny aspect of what the unintended consequences of that unmanaged migration can do, which is the setting back of the rights of sexual violence is getting completely out of control in some neighborhoods and cities in Europe. What surprises me is not the fact that that's happening. What surprises me in the book, what should surprise you, is what are these governments, leaders on the local, the provincial, the national, and the supranational, so in the EU level, all of these levels of government, what is it exactly that they are doing about the unintended consequences of immigration or migration? And the answer to the question is bleak. They're throwing the ball back and forth. There's not much happening. There's complete gridlock there. And this gives an opportunity to the far right and the populist wings and forces in that continent, and also the radical Islamists, to be the ones to hold narrative, to produce policies, and to divide the population into those who are either for that extreme or that extreme. And the center is left with no hold. So if in the US we think, gosh, gridlock, all lost, wait a second, hold it right there. Look at what's going on in Europe.
Ayana, you spent some time in European politics. And so this is something that you understand from that perspective. So I'm now going to go around with one more set of questions. And by the way, audience questions, please put them into Q&A, and I'll monitor those and ask those of our panelists. But Ayan, so you believe that the unintended consequences of this migration is really empowering radical Islamists and empowering the far right. And it's really having an effect on women's rights and women's lives, as for instance, sexual violence. When you were in European government, European politics, was this even an issue? Did people bring this issue up? Did people try to bring this issue up? Or obviously Europe has perhaps waited too late. So talk a little bit about how it looked a couple of decades ago.
A decade and a half ago, when I was in politics, people did bring it up, and it was a minority of people, and we were all reassured. I was a part of that minority where I was saying, wait a second, the civil wars that we're seeing that are ongoing, it started with the falling apart of the Balkan. So that is, in terms of proximity, the Europeans understood what was going on, what was called the former Yugoslavia. And then there were their colonies. So in France, it was countries like Algeria. And then in Britain, it was various countries in Africa. But these countries were falling apart, and there was no more, you know, policeman, big guy up there that was coming in either from the Soviet Union or from the United States of America that was saying, let's keep things together through editorships. We were getting into anarchy. And then fast forward 10 years later, the Arab Spring started to occur, what was called the Arab Spring, and the failure of states continued. And one thing that people didn't realize back then was how young the demographics are. So in the continent of Africa, 1 billion people strong, most people are under the age of 30. Whereas in Europe, people are over the age of anywhere above 50. We'll get into the details of this, But if you ask me, were there people back then addressing these issues? Yes, they were a minority, a teeny tiny minority, and they were dismissed as bigots, alarmists, people who weren't up and going with the way things were going to be. They divided. I think now we use the term globalist in the United States of America, but back in Europe, we were using the word cosmopolitan. So if you had a university degree and you were working in, your occupation was any place where you didn't have to work with your hands, then you were a cosmopolitan. You traveled the world, you were sophisticated, you knew what was going on, but a majority of the country, of any of those various countries, were still working with their hands and may or may not have had individuals within their particular families who had been to university or not. And so those people were dismissed as not open to the world, longing for what had been and what is not going to come back. And I think they underestimated the consequences of that. So 15 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, things that could have been done that would have made into a win-win. We could have had immigrants into Europe. We could have had programs to assimilate them into European society. And it would have been a win-win for both sides. All of those opportunities were lost, they were squandered, and now here we are.
Oh. I'll ask you later about Somalia, but let me just go to Liz. There's actually a question in the Q&A that I was going to use for an next round with you. Women in China. Ayan has been talking about the effects of certain policies on women in Europe, the immigration. China has this reputation, at least, of having equality for women. So if I could ask you to talk a little bit about that, and also, as a woman dealing with the Chinese, how do you find it?
Sure. So it's true. You know, Mao very famously said that women hold up half the sky. But I think if you look at China's political system today, you find out that they may hold up half the sky, but they have far fewer hands that are holding up their half of the sky, because women are sorely underrepresented in China's political system. You know, at the very top level of the Politburo, sort of the top 25 people, there, you know, is one woman in that. And that's down from two, you know, back in 2012. And if you look at the next level down, the sort of top 200 in the Central Committee, I think it's about 4% women. And even in the entire Communist Party, so 90 odd million members of the Chinese Communist Party in China, you know, there are less than a third, about 26% of the members of the Chinese Communist Party are women. So there is, you know, very poor representation, sort of a big lack of gender equality within Chinese, in the sort of elite elements of the Chinese political system. They fare a little bit better when you look at sort of the number of billionaires, actually. There are a good number of Chinese female billionaires. I think over a third of sort of the self-made billionaires in the world today that are women, about 67, are from China, so that's good. But they also face a lot of challenges, you know, women in business and really in all sectors in China, in part because, you know, their employment opportunities are constrained when they get pregnant. They're a good decade, you know, I would say, behind the United States, at least, in terms of how they look at women. You know, women who are pregnant they're not supposed to be, but they can be, you know, fired, they get paid less. They still have a lot of companies where they advertise for women who are attractive for the positions. So the feminist movement is alive and not that well in recent times because the Chinese government has cracked down on it. But there are a lot of very, strong women, women comics. They're there, but their opportunities, I would say, are still not great. As far as being a woman and doing research in China, you know, I think honestly the sort of the biggest disappointment is really that, you know, when I participate in, you know, track two dialogues or I'm engaging in my research, there are so few women. You know, there are basically two women that the Chinese trot out for any kind of discussion, a foreign policy discussion, you know, a former ambassador and a former PLA general. And you know, year after year, it's the same two women. So, you know, because they constrain, you know, the opportunities for engagement in foreign dialogues, you know, they've just identified these people. And so I feel sad, quite frankly, that for so many of the younger Chinese scholars, because they are out there, female scholars, that they're not getting the opportunities to engage with their foreign counterparts. And I think this is only going to be to the detriment of their own scholarship moving forward. So not an ideal situation, I would say, for women in China today.
Yeah. And Rose, you were in a position no woman had held in NATO. There are women who are very powerful in the States. Angela Merkel would come to mind as perhaps the most powerful leader in Europe, but still, you've done everything from negotiate arms control agreements, where you had to know, as a detractor once said about me, you mean you really care about bombs and bullets? This was actually a Soviet general who said this to me, and I said, yes, actually I do. But you must have run into some of that both at NATO and in negotiating. What was it like to be a woman in international security, where throw weight, where actually you did know what throw weight meant?
Well, I was going to say to Liz, I often ask myself, where is it worse for women? Is it in today's China or today's Russia? Because I know, Condi, we both remember when there wasn't a woman to be seen except the Minister of Culture, who was the former cosmonaut. But otherwise, forget about it. There are a few here and there, but there still are not women in the upper levels of the diplomatic corps by any means. I'll just tell a funny vignette that I recount in my book, which is noting this, and that there are only men in the front row at the table on the Russian delegation. I began a kind of secret campaign to get women to sit at the table and actually begin to deliver talking points on behalf of the Russian delegation. And by golly, it worked. It took me almost the whole year of negotiation, but finally the very capable woman lawyer was allowed to come and sit at the table and present her very good legal analysis of a point that we needed to get completed for the treaty to be completed. And so I think, you know, I've been fighting small guerrilla wars on behalf of Russian professional women. I don't know, Liz, if you feel the same about any of your efforts, but in the end of the day, I had to conclude my little efforts were probably not going to be sufficient for their careers. There really has to be a sea change in both of those societies, because they're missing out on so much talent, such enormous talent. You talked about the younger researchers, but I also think that there are really good young researchers and good diplomats too in Russia who are women, and they're just never gonna rise up through the ranks. As far as my own experience, and all of the women on this call know this, and many in the audience, I know you have to have a tough hide. There is no way, there is no way around it, because it is often unforgiving, and the games that can be played, both by foreign counterparts and by sometimes by your own countrymen, can be really extreme. So you just have to have a hard, tough hide and see your way through it. But I'm so impressed by the caliber of the young women I see at Stanford, as you know, an example, but elsewhere in academia in our country, that I think, you know, they can do it. They can develop tough hides. And one person on this call, definitely Ayan, has been through so much and has been able to do that. So it's survival tactics in the end of the day, but it's how you manage to get through. And the last thing that I will say about my service at NATO, people often do suspect that it was, you know, that overarching, perhaps, male orientation of a military alliance. There was some of that at play, but quite honestly, the Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who, by the way, is speaking at Stanford CSAC tomorrow in our European Security Initiative lecture series. So if people are interested, they should check it out. But he was very supportive from the outset in bringing women into junior and then middle management. There is still a glass ceiling at NATO that is beginning to crack. I guess I was one of the first cracks in that. But I do think that the institution, even in my time there, had started to change. The momentum was moving in the right direction. And we were even seeing on the military side of the institution some more women commanders. The Canadians were very proud to say that they were commanding several operations, including in Iraq, including their battle group in Latvia, both commanded by women in the last couple of years. So there are big changes happening, and I think it's going to be incumbent on NATO leadership to continue to push those big changes.
Right, and Amy, I'm gonna ask you to address a couple of things that have come up in the Q&A, as well as your own experience. Intelligence is still not overrepresented with women, although we've now had a director of the CIA who was a woman. You also have experienced as an academic being in these fields within the academy. Which is worse, intelligence or the academy? And people have also asked a couple of questions about the world of cybersecurity, where and how, both affirmatively and non-affirmatively, do women stand out in that field, very technical field. I think we could also say the same about AI. As these fields become more technical and as women are clearly not as represented in the STEM areas, how are do we think about this, maybe both in the academy and in the government sectors that you've interacted with?
Well, I would say in answer to your first question, Condi, being a woman in the intelligence community or studying the intelligence community is much easier, I think, than being a woman in the academy. So as you pointed out, Gina Haskell, our first woman CIA director, Sue Gordon was the number two in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Now Avril Haines is the Director of National Intelligence. So a lot of progress among women in the intelligence community. It's not to say there isn't more room to improve, but a real market improvement. The academy has some different challenges. So I've been a career academic, as you know. I had three kids before I came up for tenure. And there's an inescapable challenge or reality in the academy for women, which is that the biological clock coincides exactly with the tenure clock. And there's nothing you can do about either one, right? They're ticking at the same time. And so what does that mean? I think universities have come a long way, but I will tell you that the two keys, at least for me, were number one, lower my hygiene standards for my children. And I only say that half in jest. You wouldn't want to see pictures of my kids when they were little. And number two, I think we need to think about creative ways to help women scholars. And I'll give you an example. So when I had my third kid, I asked my dean for something and people thought I was crazy. I said, I don't want maternity leave. And she said, why don't you want maternity leave? I said, because the one thing I know I can do with no sleep with a newborn is teach a class I have taught before. The one thing I know I cannot do on no sleep is write anything coherent that is good research. So I want to teach with my newborns. By the way, I can now do round the clock simulations for my classes because I'm up at 2 in the morning. And I want to delay my leave so that I can take it once my kids are champion sleepers. So the dean said yes, she took a flyer on this idea, and I was able to have then a grant from Smith Richardson and 1 year of uninterrupted research when I most needed it. And so it was that partnership and that sort of planning that enabled me to write the book that got me tenure. So I think we have to be a little bit more deliberate and a little bit more creative to help women deal with the inescapable reality that the two clocks just are going to happen at the same time. In terms of the second question you asked about cyber, boy, that's a big challenge. We have some leading women like Fei-Fei Li here at Stanford in artificial intelligence. And I think there are a lot of efforts to improve the pipeline. So I think in terms of when I think about what we can do here at Hoover and at Stanford, it is get more women into the pipeline of these critical areas sooner. Introductory classes for freshmen and sophomores where women feel like they belong. You know, the reality is that computer science, as you know, Condi, is the number one major at Stanford. That means there are a lot of women actually majoring in computer science at Stanford. Let's get those women and their male colleagues interested in international security when they're freshmen and sophomores. Let's expand the pipeline. And that's how I think we improve representation of women across cybersecurity fields.
We've got a few questions that are specific to each of you. I'm going to start with Ayan. There are a number of questions about immigration. One is, whether or not immigration is seen differently, migration in Eastern Europe and in what was once called Western Europe, or my colleague Don Rumsfeld said Old Europe and New Europe. And isn't it worse, in a sense, in those countries that were emerging from communism? And in the same regard, just the question of, can you tell us a little bit about how you would see immigration and national security policy, given that it's a big issue of debate in the United States as well? So perhaps a little bit about those topics.
Okay, so I will go Eastern Europe versus Western Europe. Eastern Europe is poorer and has fewer to actually accommodate and help immigrants, especially mass immigration, the way Northern European countries, or rather Western European countries, can do. So that is one. But what Eastern Europe has over Western Europe is that Eastern European countries are more attuned to their value system. They've just shaken off, not so long ago, I mean, for people like me, 1989 is not so long ago. Not so long ago, they were under the Soviet blanket, the Iron Curtain, the authoritarian governments. They were denied their freedom. So when you start talking about such things as liberty, about ideas and ideologies, the Eastern Europeans are more in touch with that than the Western Europeans. So for instance, when you have this encounter between Islam and the West, I think in my research that Eastern Europeans seem to be able to have that conversation in a way that I find more meaningful than Western Europeans can do. And so that's their edge. Western Europeans have the money, they have the welfare state, they have the appeal. So this is just really, from my perspective, I'm just describing things to you. So if I were to say the continent of Europe needs immigrants, and they do, and those immigrants are going to come from proximity, they're going to come from the Middle East, from Africa, from South Asia, in terms of money, who's going to pay for that? And what is it going to look like financially, and who's going to be the economic driver of that? The Western European countries have an edge. The Eastern European countries are more attuned to the value. I think they do need to work together and stop demonizing one another. And figure out not only a managed, what they have right now is a mismanaged migration crisis. Wave after wave after wave confronts the continent and the leadership, they go into gridlock. How would you improve that? You would say, let's have a managed type of thing. And maybe the Eastern Europeans would be actually the ones who would say, here's what an acculturation or an assimilation or integration process would look like. We've been through it ourselves. And then the Western Europeans might be able to say, we're going to foot the bill and we're going to do the quotas thing. Too complicated to discuss here, but if you are talking in terms of foreign policy, national security, that's where you would be going. Now, in terms of national security, when you talk about terrorist attacks, not domestic terrorists, Europeans understand homegrown white supremacy, neo-Nazi skinhead type of terrorism. They get it. Those people speak their language. Liz, from a perspective of, you know, the intelligence community infiltrating those organizations, they have that nailed. They know Germany knows how to do that. The Scandinavians, all of these countries just know how to do it. They speak their language. It's a no-brainer. What they haven't quite understood is how to deal with national security issues from Islamists, movements, organizations, sometimes helped by countries, Iran, Saudi Arabia, before a few years. I'm the kind of person who tends to say to the Saudi government, I will trust you when I see what you've actually done. So I don't give them a blank check beforehand. But in order to do something like that, you've got to go from intelligence perspective, from a diplomatic perspective, to go to what some of these countries are saying to you in the room when you're having a conversation on diplomacy and economy and so on, and what they're doing behind the scenes. And it seems to me that many European countries and leadership fail at that. And one of those failures, to give you an example, is the establishment of this entire network of Islamists that are preaching and, you know, the word preaching is about religion, but it is really convincing large communities of Muslims who are settled into France, Germany, Scandinavian countries, and with European countries to separate themselves from these societies. So when the French president starts to say, we need to stop the Islamist separatism project from the rest of French society, he does have a point. But where the failure is about, and this is the national security issue, is why did they let that happen for decades and decades and decades? And is this time different? The average French person is asking Macron, what makes you different from the previous president and all the others? You have to make things real. I want to say, I've looked at that bill that Macron has on the table that has been through the lower house and is now going through the Senate. And I find things there to me that are appealing if implemented. And what do I mean by that? I mean that they've tried to find a balance between standing up for their values. What is it to be a French man or a French woman and abide by the laws, values, norms, etc.? And not alienating or discriminating against people who are different or look different or who are immigrants who have been former members of colonials. That's what this bill is trying. It's a very hard tightrope to walk. But Macron is trying to do that. And as a first installment, I would say I approve of it, having read it. Do I sound like a politician? I apologize.
No, thank you. There are a few more foreign policy questions and then some that will return to issues about women in foreign policy. So one of the general questions, I think, Rose, you might be the best to take this on, is if you could make one key policy change in U.S. foreign policy at this point, we've got a new administration, what would be a good lever for a better American foreign policy at this point?
Well, I think, to my mind, Condi, and I'd actually be interested if others want to comment on this with regard to their own countries, China in particular, I think we have to be smarter about our sanctions policy. Here's an example, and it's not original to me. Andrea Kendall mentioned it the other day in another session I was in. She was talking about the fact that the Russians are starting to see the Chinese investing heavily in the Arctic. They have no one else at the moment to invest in the Arctic. The Russians aren't that keen about seeing the Chinese invest in the Arctic, but the Russians need their money. We, because of our sanctions policy, have essentially shut out US and European countries from investing in the Arctic. I don't want to blame Andrea if I'm somehow mischaracterizing what she had to say, but it's an example of what has accumulated in my mind as a necessity for smarter sanctions policy. We need to be able to consider when it's in our national security interest to say it makes sense for the United States and European countries to be working together with Russia in the Arctic, as well as taking appropriate measures of defense. We see the Russian buildup in the Arctic. And of course, NATO is very minded of the necessity of being able to deter and defend in the Arctic as well as elsewhere in Europe. But I think we need to be able to say, Does it make sense for us to be working together with Russia in the Arctic, as we already do in the Arctic Council, but that's quite limited activities in comparison to having a larger kind of commercial cooperation going on. So that's an issue that I'm very interested in. I'd like us to see us be smarter about sanctions policy with regard to Russia. Again, I do not want to give anybody the idea that I'm saying we should be just forgiving sanctions on Russia right and left. That is by no means what I'm saying, because I do believe that we need to continue to be tough on sanctions with regard to Crimea and all other Russian misbehavior, including the human rights cases such as Navalny, and also the issues we have with cyber attacks on the United States and our allies. But let's try to be smarter about it. And that takes a lot of work and a very fine balancing act. So, but that's, I think, would be a top priority for me if I were inside the Russia, inside the kind of big Russia desk in the current administration.
Liz, let me turn to you because, of course, the issues with China, there are also sanctions with China. Also, a number of people have asked about North Korea, one of the places in climate change. It's very often said those are places we have to cooperate with China, but maybe on this broad question about U.S. foreign policy in China, can you comment?
Sure. Let me make one point on the Arctic, which is that China is making a huge play in the Arctic, and it's just in the past couple of years, a number of the Arctic Council members, Finland and Norway, Sweden, have started to push back and not been very welcoming, actually, of Chinese investment because they've become quite concerned about the tie-in between national security and China's, economic investments. And so there's a lot at play here, but China now calls itself, it's on its way to becoming a great polar power, even though it's like 900 miles away from the Arctic. So in any case, I think it's right to be concerned and to think about ways, possibly that we would partner with Russia on this. I think more broadly, when we're thinking about US policy toward China, for me, the biggest changes that probably need to take place are some that already are with the Biden administration. For example, getting ourselves back into international organizations. China has, taken advantage of our absence as we've pulled out from various agreements and international organizations over the past 4 years. China has attempted to step in to our place, but I get, Biden administration is getting back in. I think that's important, working with our allies. But in many respects, I think the most important thing we can do, frankly, is for Congress to get its act together and to make our national security its priority. And so that we don't have, a polarized and divided Congress that is just playing for political gain, for each of the two parties. Because I think when the Chinese look at the United States, today, the narrative that's developed is really that the United States is so divided, it's so polarized that the, Congress, the administration can't get their act together, and that this is a moment of incredible strategic opportunity for China. And so if we don't get our act together, not only does it just tarnish our reputation, but it really does, affect us materially, right? And that holds true, both in terms of the values that we represent, but just in terms of our ability to, renew America, right? To do the kinds of things that the Biden administration wants to do, to get back in terms of public-private partnerships, to develop our manufacturing capabilities, all of these things, we need to be on the same page. And so for me, I would say the most important thing in terms of our China policy at this point that we're not yet doing is to get a unified sense within, our Congress.
Great. And Amy, Liz, do you want to say just one word about North Korea?
Oh, sure. I mean, look, this is an area where the Trump administration, kind of tried to break some new ground, started off with a pretty aggressive, approach. It did not materialize. The Chinese and the Russians, have moved in a very different direction from the United States. They want to engage. They're more interested in, trading and opening. And even South Korea is kind of on that page. So I think, we have to get back and start, getting back into the six-party talks, maybe five-party talks to begin with, and figure out a new strategy. I think it's clear that it's going to be incredibly difficult for us, I think, to get the Chinese and the Russians back on board to forge that kind of cooperation for a really tough sanctions regime. So I think we're going to need to, think through a new roadmap for North Korea.
Hey, yes, Amy.
I just want to jump in. I agree with everything everyone said. I think if we were to have this panel 20 years from now, and the question were, let's look back and say, what should the United States have done to advance its values, to advance its security, to advance its role in the world? And what was the missed opportunity? Which gets to your question about what's the most important foreign policy that the Biden administration could have. I think the answer would be, we need a technology innovation policy, a strategy across the US government and the private sector. This gets to Liz's point about our competition and cooperation with China. We are in a fundamentally different landscape during the Cold War, where the high politics of security and defense played out separately from the global economic system. And now those two things are merged. And so power comes from technology, and that technology is inherently dual use. It has commercial applications and it has military applications. So if we don't win the race for standards, right, whether it's 5G or AI or quantum, we won't have the economic clout. We won't be able to set the international norms. We won't be able to shape the international order in a way that benefits our freedoms and the freedoms of other people around the world. I think if the Biden administration had to do one thing strategically, it would be focused on an innovation and technology strategy.
Let me ask a couple more questions from the, and then return to a few questions to wrap our panel about women and national security and international security. There's a question about women in Saudi Arabia, and how should we think about what's happening in Saudi Arabia? We read women are driving, we read women, such as it is, can participate in elections. Maybe Ayaan, you'd like to take that one on. And there actually is also another Middle East angle. I'm going to go back to Liz. Is China involved in the Middle East? We hear China everywhere. Is China also involved in the Middle East? So Ayaan, would you take on the women in Saudi Arabia first?
Yeah, I'm happy to take the women in Saudi Arabia. And it is really, we have a paradox. So the Biden administration has a paradox on its hands, where the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, and whoever his administration is, God help us all, say they are committed to this modernizing and modernization of Saudi Arabia, which is going to have, I would say, and I hear this from Saudi women and other Arab women, it's going to have a positive effect on the push that Saudi women have been trying for years and years. This crown prince have given them the right to drive. He's taken the morality police off the streets. He's allowed them to work. He's allowed the table to come in. He's inviting Western investors to come in. What else has he done? There's just a whole list of things that he's done and he's doing. Now, if you're a feminist and you're in, you know, you behave like we behave in America as feminists, you might end up in Saudi Arabia, you might end up being in jail, so you just have to deploy different tactics. But the dance that the Biden administration have to do is that they have to condemn the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia. We have to reset our relationship with Saudi Arabia on the one hand. We also have to figure out how we are going to, in the Middle East, not be seen as, and when I say we, I mean the United States, not be seen as allies of Iran or allies of Saudi Arabia or favoring this or favoring that party. But if I look at this particular crown prince, I would say when he has that 2030 plan of his, whatever modernization plan he has, it is good for women. Whatever we can get out of it, let's get out of it. And for me to say that is incredibly difficult because I know that country and I know all the harm they have done worldwide. But for me to come out and say, right now, like in the, I don't know, this is really what politics is all about is choosing the lesser evil. And for me, I would say, let's help this crown prince accomplish the modernization goals that he says he is committed to, and hold him accountable for those, rather than help the forces that are trying to oppose him, and we might find ourselves, you know, back into the Middle Ages, the way Saudis do things. Again, to sound like a politician, but you have, Kondi, you've been in that place. You've got to make these terrible choices. Mohammed bin Salman authorized the chopping up of a journalist in a consulate in a third country, Turkey. That's a fact. There are no other words for it than to condemn it. And if Saudis do business that way, there's nothing we can do but to condemn it. And I'd say, let's stand up to that. But right now, that evil person we are talking about who has done evil deeds is opening up a door for modernity and modernization to come in. And I think that the Biden administration should not close that door down. And it is up to us as Americans and other Westerners to figure out how we're going to do that.
Yeah, you put it very well. You know, having been Secretary of State, you rarely are presented with two good choices. You're usually presented with two very difficult, maybe even bad choices. And you have to try to reconcile very often the need to express our values with the fact that other things are going on, like the modernization of the Middle East, which was also demonstrated in the Abraham Accords. With Bahrain, which are going to end the war, the state of war with Israel, in order to modernize their countries. And so always contradictory in the Middle East, always contradictory. And maybe Liz, that's why the Chinese should stay out of the Middle East. Would that be a good argument to them?
I think that the Chinese are, you know, trying to find the right balance, and they're doing a pretty good job of it, which is to say, look, they're not going to, you know, get mucked up in human rights issues in the Middle East, because they've got obviously their own enormous human rights issues that they, you know, right now need to contend with. And so I think that makes them in some respects easy allies. And they certainly have been investing in the Middle East for a long time. You know, Saudi Arabia is China's largest source of oil, right? So imports most oil from Saudi Arabia. And I think a number of other Middle Eastern countries are within the top, you know, 8 to 10 as well. So it's, you know, important. They've also become much more engaged, you know, on the ground. So Chinese actually, you know, on the ground in the Middle East investing. And China, the interesting thing to watch from my perspective now is less about the economic engagement than the military engagement, because we now have, you know, China, Russia, and Iran doing naval exercises together. And I think increasingly China wants to, you know, play in that space, right? It's taking, you know, enormous stakes in a number of ports, you know, questions about whether or not it's going to develop, you know, military bases or logistics bases in many other countries. And so I think it sees itself, it's also, I should say, the, you know, third largest purveyor of arms, seller of arms globally. You know, some people think it's going to surpass Russia. So what's interesting for me to think about actually at this moment is whether or not, you know, sometime in the not too distant future, you might have a little bit of a competition between Russia and China on the security front in the Middle East, because there has long been a sort of divide, right? China was the economic player, Russia was the security player. You know, as China, you know, grows and grows and becomes, you know, even more a global power, you know, does Russia feel increasingly squeezed out? I think that's going to be an interesting space to watch.
All right, I'm going to try a little bit of a lightning round here, and I'm going to give one question to each of you to end. Amy, a question about how COVID has affected women in particular. I know your kids all moved home, but aside from that, and your kids are college age, with the exception of your daughter, who will soon go to college. But women in terms of all of the things that women are expected to do, you must hear it from young women. Can you talk a little bit about COVID and women?
Yeah, so there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, I think just a day or two ago, talking about actual data showing that women are dropping out of the workforce at faster rates than men because of COVID, and this is a huge challenge. And of course, in the academy, the data shows that women are actually taking on much more of the homeschooling, the work around the house. And so there's a point where, you know, what's the solution to this? Well, universities are saying, let's extend the tenure clock. But now the gap is even greater between men of the same cohort and women of the same cohort, because the men have been able to publish more while the women have not. So there are real challenges with COVID, I think, and sort of long-term effects of women in the workforce and leaving the workforce and women in it. That said, there are also real benefits to COVID. Then the challenge is, how do we accelerate those benefits, right? So remote work, for example, is much more accepted now than it was pre-COVID. And some industries that never would have thought about so much remote work, like financial advising, for example, it's now the new normal. So can we capitalize on those gains in productivity to make it easier for women to actually stay in those workforces? So I don't think it's all bad news, although there's a lot of it. And I think the challenge, and I'm hearing this a lot from intelligence agencies too, is how can we capture what we learned about remote work, even in a classified environment, to do what we do better so people can live and be more flexible and how to balance their responsibilities without sacrificing productivity.
Ah, great. Liz, a question about younger self. What would you tell your younger self, particularly as a woman in a field that is not dominated by women? And how have you gotten through it when tough times have come, when maybe somebody thought you walked into the wrong meeting, which has certainly happened to me?
Sure. I would say that, when I was younger, I didn't fully appreciate the obstacles that I actually confronted. You know, I was not laughing, but sympathizing with Amy's story on the tenure front. You know, my first boss, when he was hiring me, he asked me what my husband did. And I said, you know, he's a junior person in the finance industry. And he said, good, then I don't have to pay you much. And my response at the time was, oh, that's true, you know? And I think back to that now. Now, I will say I made him pay later, you know, but I would, at the moment, you know, it seemed perfectly reasonable and logical to me that that was the case. It became less reasonable and logical, you know, as I got older, certainly. And, you know, I watched, you know, various bosses talk to my male colleagues about how, oh, you had a new child, you know, now you can, now I'm going to give you a raise. You must need more money. Nobody came to me and said, oh, you've had another baby. Let me give you, a bump up in your salary. You know, that never had that conversation. So I think, you know, if I were looking back at my younger self, and I think many younger women are better at this than maybe some of us were at the time. And it's just to be, you know, step forward and recognize, you know, that, you know, you have the right to claim your space and your voice. And to ensure that you are treated equally, you know, at every step of the way, and, you know, never take a step back. And I'll end with this. You know, I was on a panel just last week, and with two men, and, it was a contentious discussion, and they were somewhat dismissive at points. And after it was all over, I must have gotten 30 emails from women and men, just saying, thank you for not, stepping back. Thank you for holding your ground. It's really important. So even at this, you know, late stage in my career, you can still face this kind of sort of challenging circumstance with men.
Last question, I'm going to ask it of Ayan and then finally of Rose. A couple of people have asked, you know, there's always this sense, maybe women in leadership, does it make a difference to the kinds of issues that get raised in these kinds of fora? And and Rose, maybe to you, is it true that women lead differently? You've watched, you've been yourself a leader, but you've also watched some very powerful women. And so, Ayan, could you speak to this question of whether issues get raised differently when women are in the room? I will say that I remember issues around rape as a consequence of war or mm-hmm. rape as a weapon of war. And it was the female secretaries of state and foreign ministers that got it recognized as a weapon of war, that people actually used it. So this question of how do women bring different issues to the table?
They're expected to. So people know that issues are going around. So the subject of my book, Pray, sexual violence in Europe has gone up as an unintended consequence of immigration. Women are expected to bring it up. Women leaders are expected to bring it up. If women don't bring it up, it's not going to happen. So you have a point in that. I think that what Liz said about using your voice is completely important. I totally agree with you. It's just how do you do that without coming across as the victim? See, I have a sense of pride. I have a sense of achievement. I have a sense of myself and who I am. I'm not looking for pity. I want to change things. So if I say, you know, I've just had a baby, I'm trying to balance things, I'm not looking for that condescending tap on my shoulder. I'm looking for how can we resolve this as a society? And it's true that it is women who are supposed to raise these questions and who do raise these questions. Dropping out of the workforce, childcare, Amy, I completely agree with you. I have never been more productive in my life than during COVID because I don't have to commute. I don't have to do the small talk in the office. I sit down 5 minutes before, 15 minutes before, you know, whatever the tech arrangement is. A lot of women are feeling the women who do the sort of work that we do, that you can do behind a screen. So I'm not talking about the women who actually have to physically be in their workplace. So that has been great. But I also want us to be wary of one thing, which is decision-making is gendered. I don't think that's true at all. I think, Kondo, you know this better than me, when you were Secretary of State, you were presented with these terrible options and you have to make those decisions and you're making that on behalf of your country. And it doesn't matter if you're female, male, young or old, gay or straight. It really, you have to make those decisions. And I hate it when people confuse that. I hate it when I'm asked, will you vote for this person to be president or vice president just because of their gender or their skin color? I hate that because I know how difficult those decisions are and how superficial things like skin color and gender are. So that's my two cents about it. And let me tell you, when I was doing the research on this book, the worst mistake in the 21st century, mistake, I don't think it was intentional, was made by a woman leader, Angela Merkel. 2015, she said, open the doors to immigration. Didn't do it quite the way I'm doing it. But I think in history, it will go down as one of the worst decisions made in the post-war climate in Germany. That was made by a woman. And I want to give that woman leader, Angela Merkel, the exact same compassion I would give to a man leader, which would be, it was a moment, she was asked to show compassion, she did. And if she were to come out today and said, that was a mistake, I think that would be a great trait of leadership. I'm not sure many men would do that, but as a woman, she did it, it would be wonderful. And so it's complicated.
That's really good. Rose, you're gonna get the last word about this issue of women in leadership.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm going to pick up on something Ayaan just said. And in fact, I'm going to pick up on Angela Merkel, because, you know, the cliche is that women leaders are mother figures. And Angela Merkel has never had any kids, but she's known as Mutti in Germany, you know? So she has this cliche surrounding her of being this kind of mother figure. So I think in a certain way, we have to fight back against that. But I think we also have to embrace it, because I think it means anybody, you know, who's had to juggle all the things Amy's been talking about earlier in our session today, and Liz, they understand that you do have to juggle a lot, and you have to be able to deconflict and tell what's most important and what's less important. So there's a practicality to that image that I think is very good. And it also means you're deeply attuned. And again, research has shown this, that peace processes work best when women are at the table, because they are deeply attuned to what is going on down to the village level, down to the basic units of society, the family or the tribe. And they can tell the men around the table what needs to be in the solution set. So I do think that in some ways we have to, you know, stand tall against just that cliche of being the Mutti, being the mother, but we also have to embrace it, because it means we're the problem solvers.
Well, thank you very much, ladies, for a really wonderful, wonderful session. And I can say one thing, the Hoover Institution is a better place because of your presence, because of the experiences that you bring, and because the Hoover Institution, which really does want to contribute to a better world for free peoples, we know that we've got great voices in each of you to help do that. So thank you very much. Thank you to our audience. I hope you've enjoyed this session. Happy International Women's Day. Happy National Women's Month. But remember, we're here all of the time. All of the women that you've just seen here don't just work on International Women's Day or during Women's Month. We work 365 days a year. Thanks so much.